Hello, Internet! Welcome to episode 197 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast. There's a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is my very lovely hostess, Erin Paulette. How are you doing, Erin? That's how you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, it's not bad. I had a nice weekend, and honestly, there's really no point in me wishing people a happy Easter after the fact. I'm not sure exactly if Passover will be over by the time this airs. Okay, for those of you who care, this past weekend, Easter, Passover, and Ramadan all happened at the same time, which happens something like once every 33 years, which is, I thought was pretty cool.
That is cool.
So I had an entirely adequate Easter. It's just that I'm looking at the main topics and I am not enthused. I realize that because I'm part of this podcast, I need to engage, but I don't wanna. And so it's not that I'm feeling bad. It's just, How are you doing, Weird?
I'm doing well. We had we went up to Maine for Easter, and we just did a quick day trip up, and though we returned considerably lighter, minus my daughter who is on school vacation this week, and my parents are like, "We'll take her." And we're like, "Cool. We'll decide if we take her back." So yeah, I am looking forward to a slight vacation, and had the wonderful joy of my wife and I were both tired today. I don't know. I felt like I slept all right, but I just woke up with that tired headache that you just get and you can't shake. And so after lunch, I laid down and took a nap. And just as I was waking up, she came in and climbed into bed. I said, "What are you up to?" She says, "I'm taking a nap too." And I said, "All right, well, I'll leave you alone." And then I came back upstairs just to make sure that she wasn't still sleeping, because there is nothing worse than waking up from a nap when it's time to go to bed. Oh, no. And she was awake, and I said, "Okay, just checking to make sure you're awake. I was going to cook dinner." And she says, "I'm not really hungry." And I'm like, "So I'll go downstairs and have leftovers?" She says, "Yeah." She says, thank you so much for changing your plans. And I'm like, "You just told me I didn't have to cook dinner." Hells yeah. So yeah, didn't have to cook dinner. Don't have to take a kid to school tomorrow. Oh, good times. But so that's that. That is my leisurely vacation. I still need to clean the toilets. They're disgusting.
Oh, dear listeners, I am so sorry. I have no control over what comes out of his mouth. Sometimes he thinks we care about what he talks about, and we don't. I can only apologize.
Erin, do you know what the listeners care about? They care about your reaction to the things that I talk about. I still like Heinrich from Geeks, Gadgets, and Guns posted the manic guy with the yarn board behind him of the Weird talking about anything, and then Erin patiently waiting so she could say, "Okay."
Oh, that's only been posted to the Discord. We're going to have to post that to the Facebook group so that other people can enjoy it.
We absolutely should. It's pretty hilarious.
Oh my God, you actually made that for me. You know, artisanal, handcrafted Maymay. Oh,
yeah. What's hilarious is you're like, well, his first version didn't say Erin on it, and she's like, "That's about me, isn't it?" And he's like, "Absolutely about you."
Actually, I did. It wasn't even a question. I knew. It was just, "Oh, this speaks to me. Thank you."
It wasn't even remotely a question either, because especially just the okay. I am not going to feed into this madness any further. Anything more than okay would be simply encouraging him. He might do more. But so yeah, we've got some news stories. They're not the most uplifting at all. I'll there's a little spin. I just felt that we kind of needed to talk about them. But we have a rather oversized interview on this podcast, so it's going to be a little bit of a different format than usual, just because we normally do short form, and this is going to be a little bit of a long form interview. But I think it's also very important. So yeah, we're going to be recording this the Monday after Easter. So was it after we finished recording last week, was the New York subway shooting?
I actually don't remember. That week was so crazy for me that I kind of avoided a lot of things and just did some self-care. And yeah, I knew that there was a New York shooting and I didn't get into it. It was just, okay, being a firearms rights activist, maybe this is tangentially my circus and my monkeys, but it was just, I can't bring myself to look into it, especially since the 24-hour rule was still in effect, and then other things happened, and I got caught up, and it was just, yeah, I know very, very little about it, which is really not a good look for a co-host for a podcast. So, heck, at least I know something about this as opposed to the other two. It's like, oh, I just found out today.
Yeah, this went down on the Tuesday after we finished recording, so it had not yet happened. But yeah, at the same time, yeah, if it's fairly, I will sometimes even avoid a subject if we're inside the 24-hour rule, because yeah, there's so much nonsense. So I must say, recently haven't gotten quite as much nonsense as we have in the past. I don't have the really, really outrageous stories where it's just one of those like, yeah, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But for this case specifically, this guy, not going to name his name, though I will say that he had an extensive criminal record and also shares the name of a famous outlaw, which I found amusing. Went down into the New York City subways popped a smoke bomb of some sort, and then must have just started firing indiscriminately into the crowd. And by pure luck, honestly, he killed nobody. He injured quite a few people, and quite a few more people were injured trying to get away from him in that instance. And then several days later, the police caught him and apprehended him.
Yeah, okay. The police caught him because he called them, said, I think I'm the person you're looking for. I'll be at such and such McDonald's at such and such a time. He all but turned himself in. And this is the part that doesn't make sense to me. Looking at the timeline here, this was very obviously premeditated, because there's a fair amount of forethought and logistics that go into it. But at the other hand, he was incredibly sloppy about the whole thing. Like, he didn't care if he was caught. And then at the end, I think I'm the person you're... He doesn't even take credit. I don't know if this is a person with some sort of psychological issues or what, but he, from what I can tell, and honestly, I don't have a whole lot of information on here, this just doesn't seem to fit the social profile of either a terrorist or a spree shooter. He doesn't really seem angry, and he doesn't, you know, a spree shooter would be, oh, I did it. You know, get my name in the papers. And
well, the anger thing I'm not so sure about, because of course this is all after the fact. That there are a number of posts that exist of his social media profiles that have been completely scrubbed and locked down, with all sorts of, you know, racial and extremist views on them. So the potential that maybe he was a very, very angry person, you know, is a possibility. But at the same time, also the nature of what he was doing with the smoke bomb, and it is a very, very strange case. So yeah, that. But he has been apprehended. It was very, very interesting that the mayor of New York City announced that it was not a terrorist attack, and yet he is in federal custody, not New York, not in the custody of the New York City police. Because
I literally thought he had been arrested for, you know, a terror crime.
Exactly, he was arrested for a terror crime, but the day after. The shooting, there was an official announcement that said that it was not believed to be terrorist.
Then it was a spree shooting, and like I said, with a lot of spree shooters, I can understand their reasoning. Someone is bullied at school and wants to shoot people at school. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's right, and I don't agree, but I can at least follow the reasoning.
Yeah. Or you've got these absolute utter losers that know that they will, I mean, almost all of the spree shooters, especially the young ones, idolize the Columbine killers. There's always something in there where they studied Columbine and other shooters and had idolizations of them, because so many of them, the only thing that they have ever done of consequence is kill a whole bunch of their fellow students. So that's where they go, haha, I can leave my mark on the world, which, I mean, as you said, there's some mental illness, because anybody that puts those two, you know, those two things together, clearly is not playing with a full deck.
Mm-hmm. But, oh, I'm beating this dead horse. Cut that part out. I don't know. I feel like I need to explain my frustration and my confusion, but I end up just repeating myself.
Mm-hmm.
That it doesn't make sense. If he was this, he would have done it this way, but he didn't. He did it this other way, which would mean he was this, but he's not. And why does he not? And I'm getting worked up, and this guy doesn't deserve that from me.
No.
So, in with the Gandhi, out with Hitler. Okay, move on.
And that was one of the spree killings that has happened very recently. And then over this weekend, there were two. I've heard about a third one. I didn't really catch that one on the news. And these are all being kind of listed as mass shootings, even though they don't fit the FBI's definition. And there is I think that there are two very interesting aspects of the ones that I'm talking about. This next one that happened was appeared to be like a massive block party being held inside an Airbnb. It says like there was more than 200 people there, and it seems like most of them were underage. And, you know, honestly speaking, it sounds like a pretty good time. If Airbnb had existed when I was that age, it certainly could be an interesting way to have a fun weekend. But, in the case of this, shots, rang out. This happened the other day. So we're still well in the bubble of exactly the course of events. Mm-hmm. But according to the police, investigation, I think, well, two people were killed, a whole bunch of people were injured, either through gunshots or from getting injured and trying to escape. There's a whole bunch of, it says here in the report that's listed in the show notes, more than 90 rounds were fired, though they said the shot spotter in the area may have triggered more of them, though ShotSpotter is notoriously unreliable, so I would take that with a grain of salt. But also multiple calibers were recovered as well, which implies that there were several different guns used. And I've got to say, this really does reek of more of a gangland type activity, given that just about everybody at this party was underage, yet there was lots and lots of guns there. It's not and there's been absolutely no account that it was a single individual.
Mm.
So
plus there were more than 200 people present at mm-hmm. this party.
Yep.
So, you know, a gathering that large, you are likely to get some ne'er-do-wells, just mm-hmm. law of averages.
That's true. So it may not have even been, you know, directly gang related. It could have just been, yeah, there was a couple of bad apples in there that felt disrespected. But time will tell about this one, and we'll report if there's anything interesting. And if there's nothing interesting on this story, we'll leave it the hell alone. But this reminds us very much of the Sacramento shooting that happened, in the fact that this is being kind of mentioned as a mass shooting. We'll see how much traction this story gets over the next couple of days. My prediction is not a whole heck of a lot, but it seems like it is definitely more of the level of street violence and just in a crowded format.
Mm-hmm.
And this next one is, I saved this one for last because it is by far the most interesting. It took place at a mall in South Carolina. And I will name the shooter in this one because his name is Jawayne Price. He's 22 years old. And he ended up shooting at, I think he said, two other people mm-hmm. in the mall. And his statement was that he was attacked by these people and fired in self-defense. He has a clean criminal background, but legally purchased the gun that he had, though he did not have a South Carolina concealed carry permit. And he was, according to the police, quite cooperative with them when they arrived on the scene. And because of this, he was given a $25,000 bond, which I believe means that he had to pony up $2,500, because I believe it's 10% is actually all that's required to be paid out in cash. He was actually the one that called the police. So he called the police to the scene of the shooting. And mm-hmm. And the only thing the police have charged him with is carrying a gun without a permit. And then they've released him. They've given him an ankle monitor, and they've released him on bond. And I would argue that probably the only reason why he got the ankle monitor is because there is the potential that this might not have been a defensive shooting. And in the event that they are reviewing witness reports, security cameras, et cetera, they may find that, oh yeah, no, he definitely, or even social media stuff, that he may have provoked this attack, that he might face some larger charges that would be much more serious and worthy of them finding out exactly where he is right now. So yeah, I found it to be an interesting, oh, he is also African American, if that is important to you. It was good to see just really just a standard thing with when you have some of these shootings is, especially with the police related ones on the, if you are resisting arrest and causing a whole lot of problems and fighting with the cops and all that, it doesn't go, you're not doing yourself any favors. And in this case, this guy said, I was acting in self-defense. It sounds like, because it was a mall, there was probably security camera footage and lots of eyewitnesses. So that also is probably in his favor, which makes me think that, yeah, he's not telling tales.
Let's not forget the fact that 9 people were injured in this exchange of gunfire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is, yeah. So it is a big deal. I mean, it's a crowded shopping mall. I was just pleased to see that they didn't have any trumped up charges to throw at him. They released him on his own recognizance under bond and with just an ankle monitor, and this was a self-defense. And I just wanted to also note that, again, in a world where Georgia has now become the 25th state to have constitutional carry, the fact that he's being charged with carrying without a permit is you know, almost getting to be an archaic charge in the fact that so many states don't bother with it. And actually, in the article that I have listed in the show notes, there is a Democrat representative who's presented a bill that has multiple sponsors to reduce the penalties for carrying a concealed weapon without a permit. Saying that it's a minimum fine of $1,000 currently, along with a maximum sentence of a year behind bars, and they would commute that to a $200 fine if it's your first offense, which, honestly speaking, seems quite reasonable, because if that's all they've got you on is that somebody saw the, you know, your gun printing and the officer said, "Hey, can I check your permit?" And I don't have a permit. Well, we'll have you pay a fine and go get a damn permit if you're going to carry the gun.
So here's something interesting that you missed. The counsel for the defense is J. Todd Rutherford. Rutherford is also the aforementioned state representative.
I did miss that.
And he is not only a Democrat, but he is a pro-gun Democrat. And he's one of the sponsors of the bill that could reduce the penalty for carrying a concealed weapon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm mystified how a state representative, a full-time job, how he manages to also find the time to be a defense lawyer. But apparently he does. That'll be interesting. I'm not sure if this is a conflict of interest. I mean, not with the person he's defending, but considering that he helps pass the law that might affect this guy. I don't know. It's just, wow, that's unusual. I've never seen this before. I wonder how this is going to turn out.
Well, I don't know how South Carolina runs it, but I know specifically Texas and New Hampshire. Being a state representative or senator is very much a part-time job, because they are only in session for a certain number of days, and it's not really that many days. So it is very, very easy, especially for someone who is self-employed, such as a lawyer, can very, very easily keep their practice going. And just, you know, either have some other lawyers in the practice or some friendly lawyers that you can throw business to if in the event that you are going to be busy with legislative action. But it very much can be a part-time job on the state level. It, you know, once you get to the federal level, it is 110% a full-time job, with lots of vacations and furloughs, but junkets. Gotta love the junkets. It's like a vacation, except that you can say that you're working. We're checking out the subway system of Prague. Well, there. Isn't that a great thing for you to do?
All right. We need to sort of wrap this up because we're already running long, I think.
Yep. So I teased it at the beginning of the show. Last week, President Biden announced that the ATF had a new decision on what constitutes a frame and receiver. We reported on the last episode of ACP, but honestly speaking, we were very confused. It's a long, complicated document. So I contacted the first person I contacted was lawyer Benjamin Blatt, because of his firearms expertise. And so here's my interview with him to see if we could shine any light on this subject. I'm very grateful. Let's be honest. I've got a lot of questions here. I'm grateful to welcome back to the Assorted Calibers podcast firearms lawyer Benjamin Blatt. And you were literally the first person I called when this rule came through. The it's summary of final rule 2021 R05F. Is that the actual name of this?
That's the rule, but really it's going to just be modifying various CFR portions, so no one's going to refer to it by the rule.
So let's get right down to brass tacks, Benjamin, and let's say, so what does this rule do? How does this change how the laws are going to be enforced moving forward?
So this rule changes quite a few things, but I'd actually like to start with the one silver lining I identified in here. And this one, I think, genuinely came out of them actually listening to comments. Prior to this rule, which I guess is going to be published today in the registry, and it takes effect 120 days after the registry. So right now it's still a problem, but in 120 days or so, right now, if you are Cerakoting guns and then offering them for sale, like you get in a black gun and you make it Tiffany blue, to give a local example, you are supposed to have a manufacturer's FFL because you're adding value to that gun for sale. That's per a current ATF determination. The one silver lining I've seen in this rule is that it changes the definition of permissible gunsmithing to basically say that if you are just Cerakoting an already manufactured gun, even if it's adding value, you are not required to have the manufacturer's license. Now, if you take a raw receiver and then coat it for the first time, that's still considered a manufacturing process. But just Cerakoting it to add value is no longer one of those things where you have to have a manufacturer's license or risk losing it all if the ATF decides they're going to knock on your door today. So that's the silver lining.
Now onto the clouds.
Yeah, everything else pretty much is bad and sucky. So basically what the ATF did is take an existing definition, and this is a definition that comes out of federal statute, the laws Congress makes, the way it's supposed to work, that refers to frame and receiver as being, that is a firearm. If it is the frame or receiver of a firearm, it is legally a firearm. That's the statutory law. So ATF and the Biden administration basically said, well, in 1968, when they made that law, Congress really didn't know about split receiver firearms, and they didn't really understand that new technology. Now, I have issues with that because around the turn of the last century, one of the most popular handguns ever sold, about 120 odd years ago, was a split frame handgun. In 1911, the U.S. Army adopted the 1911 pistol, which was a split frame handgun. By 1968, the U.S. Army was using the M16, which is a split receiver design, based off the AR-15, which is a split receiver design, which was based off the AR-10, which is a split receiver design, which failed in its competition against the FNFAL, the right arm of the free world, which is a split receiver design. The concept and the idea that in 1968, Congress didn't know or could not know what a split receiver or split frame firearm was is ludicrous. But that is the reasoning for ATF to come in and change some definitions to accommodate the differences between what was known in 1968 and what is known today. So what they did is they took that definition and they said, well, we're going to administratively change it to be separate definitions, a definition of frame for pistols and a definition of receiver for shotguns. And then we're also going to say that if you have a partially completed receiver or frame, or if you have the parts and tools sold with it to complete such a receiver or frame, that is in and of itself a firearm that requires a serial number. Part of this means, and part of this is what's in there, is that new designs, and they emphasize the concept of new designs of firearms that use a split frame or a split receiver will require each part to be individually serialized and marked. I'm not sure how that's going to fall out because obviously we haven't seen any new designs. But it is troubling to me that in their executive summary, they talk about modifying a receiver as such that it is now a new design, because that raises questions about whether or not if you produce a new type of AR-15 receiver, that might maybe it has the fire control group slightly laid out different or uses a different type of fire control group. Was it Iron Horse with their thumb-activated trigger?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Would that be a new design if it came out next year instead of last year?
Or the polymer what would Stoner do design, which is based on
right.
pre-existing it's based on the Cav Arms polymer receiver.
But the receiver itself is noticeably different.
Yes.
Right. Would that qualify as a new design? These are things the ATF will have to address, keeping in mind that their intent in this rule, according to their own proclamations, is that this was to clarify and avoid questions and vagueness. And everything about it is vague and questionable and leaves a lot of discretion up to the ATF.
Well, that's where I was getting on. Because so let's pick a hypothetical, you know, we'll call it, I'll say Car Arms, because they only make pistols, but Car Arms decides that they're going to make a rifle, and it is going to be a entirely different design that has all the bells and whistles of the AR-15, but updates that they think make it considerably better. And so it is not an AR-15. It is not interchangeable with an AR-15, and it is the Car Arms K-15 rifle.
Well, and there would be the key, is that it's not interchangeable with an AR-15. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things this rule does, in the name of clarifying and making things simpler, according to the ATF, is that they have produced copious picture examples and descriptions of all of the grandfathered split designs.
Yep.
Which, this is somehow better than just saying frame or receiver as marked by determination of the ATF.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a split receiver, pick the upper or the lower, that's your marked one. That was the old way. Now this is an FA and FAL. It is grandfathered in this design. This is the AR-15 family. It is grandfathered in this design. When it gets to handguns, it just lumps a bunch of manufacturers together. But, you know, then there's, I'm going to mispronounce this, but was it the Lago Alien?
Yes.
That just came out. That pistol would qualify if it came out next year. That one's a radically new design,
mm-hmm.
but it's still a split frame.
Yep.
Would that be a split frame pistol as contemplated by the rule? Or in the case you gave, this Car 15, if it's not compatible with an AR-15 upper or lower, I would say that's a new design.
Yep.
And if it's a new design, then both parts of it need to be serialized. And both parts would need to be sold as separate firearms, essentially.
That was my question on why I went to the trouble of inventing a gun that doesn't exist. Yeah. Because, you know, I can't say the SCAR 16, which is you know, picture a SCAR 16. It's kind of AR-15 like, but it's totally not an AR-15, and it's updated.
Although even with the SCAR 16, they just came out, what was it, the L version?
Yep.
Which has substantial differences from prior versions.
Mm-hmm.
If they have a new generation of SCARs that has an issue with compatibility, would that actually be a new design regardless of the name? Yeah.
But so the upper and lower on this hypothetical rifle that will be coming out next year, hypothetically, it would have two separate serial numbers on it, but one for the upper and one for the lower.
That's the way it reads, is that new designs would be both parts of a split receiver or frame, would require serialization of both parts, and both would be individually treated as firearms. And I guess they'd be sold as kind of like when you're doing NFA stuff. You buy a suppressed SBR, it's a two-stamper.
Yep.
It would be sold the same way, although, you know, they just go on the same 44-73. Although then it raises the question of, you know, if you buy two of them, and they're handguns, for instance, are you actually buying four separate firearms, and then you have to fill out one of the purchase of multiple handgun forms because you've bought four, when it's really only two functional ones? These are issues the ATF isn't quite addressing, but certainly come up from this rule.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they went to the effort of saying, oh, this design is grandfathered, this design is grandfathered, although notably the FN SCAR is not on there. I would argue it falls under their AR grandfathering, but it's not specified. They did go to the trouble of specifying some machine guns that were quick and obvious problems. And the one possible other silver lining is that by grandfathering these things and by saying existing designs are grandfathered, they don't have to deal with the problem that would have come up with the concept of, if you have an NFA registered M16, your lower is still registered in the registry, but if your upper needs a new serial number, you can't register it after 86.
Oof.
So they avoided that by saying, oh no, everything's grandfathered.
Yeah.
That would have been a serious problem. As it stands, even for manufacturers moving forward, you know, if you're designing a new type of submachine gun, for instance, are you double stamping that because both are technically separate firearms? I mean, even if it's dealer only, you're still having to pay the tax when you manufacture it.
Mm-hmm.
Our manufacturer is going to be paying twice as much tax for new designs. I think one of the huge things that's going to take a hit is innovation. We saw this in the machine gun market in general after 1986. I think we're going to see similar to this in terms of, well, people don't want to be paying twice as much for firearms manufacturing taxes, paying twice as much for the record keeping. Why would they invest in trying to make a new design?
Yeah, and it will just be trying to fit into the narrow definition of what is grandfathered within. And yeah. Again, we don't know exactly how this is going to be enforced. You were talking about, you know, the SCAR 16 is not on the list, which actually kind of shocks me because I don't see how it could be grandfathered under an AR-15 as it's, you know, the
well. And that's the question: is did they mean it to be just that kind of split receiver? Because to be fair, the AR-15 type of split receiver is distinct, for instance, from the FN type of split receiver.
Mm-hmm.
But I am going to, real quickly, since I've got the PDF in front of me, scroll back through the images and make sure that I didn't see. Nope, there's the AUG, there's the AK, there's a Thompson, there's a Sten. And it's important these all be given separate grandfathering because they are, for better or worse, very different types of split receiver.
Yeah.
So there's AR-15, M16 variant firearms. Ruger Mark IV is its own separate. The Benelli shotgun is its own separate. And then machine guns with receiver plates are their own separate.
But by the way, can we note the irony of saying that they need to update the definition because they just weren't aware, and you just mentioned the Thompson and the Sten.
Oh, yeah. Not to mention the machine gun example is Browning.
Mm-hmm.
These are all things that obviously existed before 68. And
not, you know, in obscurity.
No, not at all. Yeah, there's no specific for the FN, but there is this thing, AR-15, M16 variant firearms. But yeah, I mean, obviously the SCAR is not an AR-15 variant.
Mm-hmm.
It builds a lot on the development of the AR, but it is not a variant. Now, that said, in general, these are picture examples of specific types. And they did say they're grandfathering existing designs, so you could argue it falls in there. But I would say that a new variant of a SCAR would have questions, at least, that would need to be addressed. And one of the fun things that's in here, because of course it is there is a specific example for break action, lever action, or pump action rifles and shotguns as to what part of them is the receiver. And there's one in there for bolt action rifles as to what part of them is technically the receiver. Because even though they're not split designs as we traditionally think of them, they're not true receiver designs as the definition is determined in 1968. So even standard bolt actions and pump actions would have problems falling into that receiver properly, because Congress was full of idiots in 1968. I think the only firearm that's on there that legit Congress might not have anticipated is the SIG P320. The concept of the entire fire control group being contained as its own fire control group and dropped into what would otherwise be frames.
Mm-hmm.
But everything else is just, it's all technology. Even the AK-47, it's all technology that easily predated 1968 by decades.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a mess in that. So in terms of the effect on the industry, it's going to mean more paperwork, more markups on the manufacturing side, and I think it's going to stymie innovation. The people taking the biggest impact are going to be the 80% manufacturers who are going to have to start serializing or stop selling, because one of the key things that's in there is that you can't just say, well, I'm selling the receiver as one item and parts, kits, and jigs is a separate thing you have to order. The rule specifically states that if you are selling both and a customer can buy both at the same time, you're selling a firearm. So the only way you'd get around that is if you had like a separate company in a separate building with a separate website, and maybe the same guy owns them, and the customer can go and order the one thing from one place and order the other from another company that's in a different state.
And then there's the chilling effect, because I have openly said the only reason why I have not built an 80% gun just in my hobbying is because I'm a sucky handyman, and I know for a fact that I will throw several of them into the trash as I screw up just to make one gun. It's easier just to walk to the local shop and pick one up that's already put together.
Yeah. Well, and I've said that the only reason I have never bothered with one is that, frankly, it's always been cheaper to get a blemish arrow, and I don't have to worry about messing up the coating on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because coating them properly is a pain.
Yep.
I experimented with doing my own firearm coating like 15 years ago, and all I wound up with was a bunch of spray cans from Brownells that never got used. It just, it was a disaster from the word go. But basically, there's that for the 80% market. Although, you know, 3D printer go burr. Mm-hmm. CNC machine go burr. Can't stop the signal.
Yeah.
Well, although you can guarantee they'll try next. So that's for the 80%ers. The other huge, huge impact is going to be on your average Joe FFLs. The least impactful part of this rule is the elimination of the 20-year record rule. Because according to ATF, well, you can't be throwing things out for 20 years because there were 1,300 guns we could identify that we weren't able to trace because records older than 20 years have been thrown away. keeping in mind that the ATF has openly admitted that any gun sale that's more than a year old, they have no chance of tracing properly anyway.
And also note that the ATF is complaining about wanting to get around the rule against digitizing their records because they are actually having like structural damage in the warehouses from the weight of all the paperwork that they're retaining.
So for what it's worth, that's not contemplated in this rule, but that's something the ATF's been doing for the past few years. They have been basically compiling a registry by doing two things. One, if you look at the new Form 4473 that came out recently, all of the firearm information is now on page one. So ATF agents are notorious for taking pictures of 4473s when they do inspections. But gun shop owners are also notorious for calling them on it because they're not supposed to. Now they can take those pictures without obviously flipping documents because everything they need is on page one. That's for the paper 4473s. The other thing they've been doing for years now is anyone who uses digital 4473s, they don't come in and sit there and look on the computer at the records. They come in and grab a flash drive of the database and take it to their office to review. And then they have all the 4473s.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been compiling these records for the past several years. I think the first case that I knew of where they literally gone in and said, well, I'll just put on a flash drive rather than sit here in the office was 5 years ago. That was local to me is just, you know, direct knowledge in terms of an agent just taking an entire database of 4473s that way. But yeah, they've been working on that for the past several years. Their excuse of the warehouses and all that stuff is BS only because they never look through those papers anyway.
But again, really the requiring FFLs to retain that paperwork.
Right. Well, and the purpose there is that they're basically saying now we can look through those papers if we want. And since you have to retain it in good condition, you have to make sure you store it in a place that's not going to get weather damaged. And if we want to look at the records, we can. But mostly it's just an added expense to you.
Exactly. This is not any gun shop that is going to be open for any length of time. Like if this is going to be passing from generation to generation, the amount of paperwork they're going to have to store if they do any kind of business is
a lot. And actually, I have a story on that. One of my clients, unfortunately, had to close about 3-4 years ago. It was before COVID by a couple of years. And they'd been in business since the 60s, I think it was. And when the ATF came to collect the records, he had a shelving unit. And all the 4473s were by year, but they had to get a second van to fill it. Because he actually didn't throw anything out, mm-hmm. even past the 20-year mark. So they took everything, but it went back decades. And they had to haul it off because that's what they wanted to do. So there are shops that do that. But the point of it is not so much to make these shops spend the money on storing 20 plus years of records. The point is to convince these shops just go electronic. Mm-hmm. It's easier. That's the end goal there. They want these records all perfectly on their electronic databases, easy to read, easy to access whenever they feel like, so that they have the unofficial registry at hand and so that they can also look things up and basically move data around as they see fit. I had yet another client who the ATF tried to jack up on a straw purchase violation because the agent went through the electronic database and then went back through it using different search terms until he found two people at the same address who, weeks and weeks apart, separately tried to purchase the same gun. And he made that a straw purchase claim. Now, if a person with paper 4473s was dealing with this, not only would the ATF never have caught it, but unless it was a one-person shop and the person had a great memory, no one's catching that.
Mm-hmm.
But when you've got an ATF agent and an electronic database that, you know, they're required to use specific types of e-forms for the 4473s, and they're all easily searchable by ATF. So when you've got something like that where he can just look things up by address and see how many people are buying guns at the same address, then you can start putting together straw purchases.
You show me the man, I'll show you the crime.
That's exactly what this agent did. So, I mean, that's part of it. It's literally there just to manufacture offenses that they can nail license holders on. But that's not even the big hit to the FFLs. The big hit to the FFLs is the privately manufactured firearms requirement. Now that there is a new category and a new definition for PMFs, privately manufactured firearms, so theoretically these days, an FFL can take in a PMF. It doesn't have a serial number. It doesn't have a serial number, although you're not supposed to sell one without serializing or marking it to some extent. But there's no real uniformity requirement, and it just has to be marked. I still don't advise buying it if you're an FFL, simply because you don't know the quality of the manufacturer and you don't want the liability issues. But you could legally purchase a PMF from a private individual and offer it for sale at your FFL. This rule is going to require any FFL that possesses PMFs, even if they brought them into their inventory 2 years ago, they've got to be marked. And the rule requires that they be marked with serial numbers unique to that gun and to their inventory in the shop. Which that part's just insane, because right now you could have Colt and you could have Arrow both manufacture an AR with the same exact serial number, and ATF wouldn't care because they're different manufacturer markings. They're not considered to have reused the same serial number.
Mm-hmm.
But this rule would require a single shop to know all of the serial numbers for its entire inventory and make sure that they're not marking this home-built AR with a serial number that happens to be on the Glock that's also in their inventory. That's insanity. That's the first part of the insanity, though, because the second part is that the shop also has to put its FFL number on every PMF it marks so that the ATF can better trace the guns. But, you know, first of all, getting to the uniqueness of the serial number. If you are marking guns, and first of all, you could use the same serial number on two different guns if they're two different models, and technically, if you were a manufacturer, there wouldn't be a problem with that because they're not the same serial number. But if you're putting your FFL on there too, it's definitely unique from any serial number on any other gun that you've purchased from a manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
So they're basically saying, well, uniqueness doesn't matter, or the lack of uniqueness doesn't matter when it comes to FFLs marking these things. They have to be, you know, separate unique numbers. You got to keep track of everything. You got to report to the ATF. You got to put your FFL number on it for easier tracing. But what it means is a higher burden, and it's insane then for any FFL to buy these things, because why would you want to? Keeping in mind also that technically the PMFs would apply to any 80% kits you have in your inventory for sale, because now they're firearms. They need to be serialized before they can be sold. So if you have your 80% receiver kits in stock, you've got to serialize them. You've got to put your FFL on it, and you've got to make sure those serial numbers are unique from everything else. That burden alone is difficult for any FFL. But what makes it better, in the sense that it's horrible for FFLs, and this is something I proposed as soon as I saw it, let's say you're a criminal manufacturing ghost guns. They're not used that often in crimes, but let's say you're the dude making them for criminals. Now, previously, you didn't put any markings on them, because why would you? But now you know that ghost guns have to be marked. So you know, because it's in the rule, and because FFL lists are public information that you can get from the ATF website, that FFLs that buy and sell these things have to put their FFL number on it. Now, let's say that you remember a gun shop that didn't sell you a gun 5 years ago because you weren't a qualified person, and you're pissed at that owner. So you take your 20 ghost guns that you're manufacturing, knowing you're going to sell them on the street, and you put his FFL number on them with serial numbers. Now they trace back to this guy. First of all, how does that help tracing? It doesn't help the ATF find who made them, but now they all trace back to a gun shop that he happens to have a grudge against. That gun shop owner gets screwed because, oh, wait, we've got this gun we picked up at a crime scene with your FFL number on it, and it's not in your book. Now you're in violation and we're pulling your license. And how do you prove that negative?
Mm-hmm.
That requirement alone is almost guaranteed to not only be abused by the people actually selling these things to criminals, but to also put FFLs out of business. Because the ATF will use as a violation, knowing that there's no way to prove the negative, even if they know that there's no way this gun actually went through this person's hands and was clearly done just as a deliberate throw off. They'll still use it as a violation. And if they find three or four of them marked that way, they'll say, oh, that's multiple violations. You're definitely losing your license for this.
And since we're on the subject of home manufacture, one of the first things you said to me when I reached out to you was Home Depot may have to get an FFL. Can you expand on that?
Yes, I can. Before I expand on that, I want to note one more thing about your current FFLs that's a problem, but it kind of involves Home Depot. Repair. Let's say you made your own gun, but something broke. So you go and contact your local gunsmith and say, hey, listen, can you fix this? It's a Glock type. It needs something with the springs pin. And the guy says, sure, bring it to the shop. I'll order the parts and I'll fix it. Well, according to the ATF rule, if the guy brings in the gun at 9 a.m., and he leaves with that gun before close of business, you don't have to mark the gun. You don't have to mark it in into your inventory. But if he brings the gun in on Tuesday and you don't return until Thursday, you have to mark that gun Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, because it's overnighted in your shop. And you have to put it on your books, with that marking in serial number and inventory marker.
Wow.
Yeah. So my advice would be, I mean, there's a thing in the rule about you don't have to mark PMFs that you take into inventory for a period of 7 days, with the exception of the gunsmith one, which is has to be done immediate. But my legal advice would just be, if you're an FFL, you need a blanket policy. We do not buy your 80% build. We do not buy your unserialized firearm. Even if you can prove it was manufactured before 1968, we're not taking the risk. And we certainly do not offer gunsmith services for any of these firearms. Because to do that means that that FFL needs to keep an engraver on hand. Because the option for engraving is that either you do it yourself or you pay a third party to, but the FFL has to directly supervise, meaning be in person, watching them as they do it, any third party engraving firearms. It's insanity. So anyway, Home Depot. Moving on to insanity. Home Depot, your hardware stores in general, they sell plumbing supplies. The most simple of ghost guns, the classic, before there was 3D printing, before there were 80% lowers, was the good old-fashioned slam bang. You get two pieces of pipe, and I'm going to talk about this because I'm not talking about designing a machine gun. There's no law against me talking about this in detail. You get two pieces of pipe. One needs to be barrel length, 18.5 inches or longer. The other needs to be receiver length, so your overall length is at least 26 inches. Or you can add a stock, but two pieces of pipe, a nail, and an end cap. Maybe a piece of cork to help pad the nail. You thread the larger pipe with the end cap and the nail. You put a shotgun shell, whatever fits into the diameter of the smaller pipe. And then you slide the smaller pipe into the larger until the shell hits the nail, and boom, you got your slam bang. Easy peasy. And every hardware store in the country that sells plumbing supplies sells the parts you need. And because all you need for a slam bang is one threaded pipe to be the receiver, if a hardware store is selling threaded pipe, they are selling receivers as defined by this rule. So legally speaking, they should all be FFLs. They should all require 4473s for buying plumbing supplies, and every one of those pipes should have a serial number on it. But there's no way the ATF could ever enforce the rule to that extent. So instead, they'll just screw over the people they dislike the most, and that'll be the way it is. But your listeners can do something about that, or at least do something to crush the souls of your average ATF agent. Go to your Home Depot. Go to your Lowe's. Go to your Menards. If it's legal in your state, I'm not saying do something illegal. Buy a couple pieces of pipe. Buy a nail. Buy a thread cap. Take a picture of it. Post about your slam bang kit that you bought at your local hardware store. And be sure to tag the hardware store.
Mm-hmm.
And tag the ATF. Let them know that you bought a slam bang, because what the hell?
Slam bang kit.
Yeah. Slam bang kit. Purchased at your hardware store. So what? You're telling the ATF you have a gun. Well, you need to buy yourself a slam bang. All the others got lost in a boating accident or got stolen or whatever happened to them. But make sure you keep tagging the ATF and the hardware store you bought your kits from.
Mm-hmm.
Because according to this rule, well, if they're selling a kit that's readily convertible or readily manufacturable into a firearm, and it comes readily manufactured, all you need to do is thread that cap and it's a gun, then they're supposed to have them serialized, and they're supposed to be FFLs, and they're supposed to have you doing a 4473, because you can't stop the signal.
Yes.
Because the concept of outlawing homemade firearms or making it more difficult to make homemade firearms is so contrary to the United States Constitution and the Second Amendment, it hurts the brain.
Mm-hmm. So now, well, I think we've covered the finer points of this, or at least the grosser points of this.
Yeah. It's definitely just the grosser points. The meat of the rule, aside from the summaries and the comments, still runs to 70 odd pages.
Yes. So, now that we know the more or less the gist of how this is going to affect us and how this is not going to affect us, what do we do moving forward? Especially since I was just talking with some people, some listeners, and I was noting that this kind of reminds me of Biden's Russian ammo ban, where it technically didn't ban any ammo. It just said it wasn't going to renew any import licenses. And a lot of these licenses was good for 3 or 4 more years. So it didn't actually stop anything now, but it certainly had the potential in the future to cause
this
problems.
Will be more immediate than that.
Okay.
This is it's not banning anything. It is requiring further administrative documentation for a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
It is requiring serialization, which means, for instance, if the 80% lower manufacturers want to stay in business, they're going to have to get FFLs. They're going to have to be serializing everything. It means that anyone who's got them in inventory is going to have to get themselves an engraver and start serializing and recording and notifying the ATF. It means anyone who wants to sell their home builds that they need to sell for whatever reason to an FFL is going to have to mark them up or have them marked. And they can't just say, well, I marked this at home. You know, that's one of the fun things about this. You're not going to be able to sell a home-built firearm to an FFL and say, well, it's okay, I marked it at home. This is the serial number. The FFL is going to have to put its FFL number on there. And the only alternative is to say, well, I can't, you know, I'm not going to put my FFL number on there, but you can take this to this other gun shop and have them put their FFL number on there. Like, okay, what happened there? There's no benefit or no difference one way or the other. But it means, like, if you put your Freedom 76 serial number on an AR and say, okay, I don't want this, I'm going to sell it. Here, buy my AR. It's pretty good. I'm a good home builder. They're going to have to say, cool, well, we're going to have to mark an FFL, our FFL number on it. And unfortunately, we've had a Freedom 76 come out before in our books. So we're going to have to make up our own serial number and record that as the actual serial.
So, but what can we do? This is obviously awful. What can we do to fight? You've given the idea of tagging the ATF with Home Depot.
In terms of actual legal effective fights, FPC is talking a lawsuit. They're pretty solid in following through with what they say. GAO is talking a lawsuit. They're pretty solid in following through once FPC's followed through. NAGR, I believe, has also talked about this. They've been doing some good independent stuff, but I think FPC is probably once again going to be the lead organization. And then down the road, if there's a win, just expect NRA to take credit.
Well, I think that covers a lot of the bases, and it certainly has cleared up a lot of gray areas that I had in trying to read through these 300 some pages.
Right. Well, and to keep in mind and clarify, there's always going to be even more gray areas because 90% of this is still up to the discretion of the ATF director. So it's up to the ATF to decide what is and isn't a new design. It's up to the ATF to decide if what you thought was an existing design is in fact a new design because it's slightly modified. It's up to the ATF director, of course, to decide how to enforce these rules and also to define all the vague things they've added into it.
And of course, as we know from things like pistol braces and things like that, just because they said it was okay yesterday doesn't mean it's okay today.
Right. Well, and the pistol brace thing, the ATF publication about their budgetary needs suggests that the pistol brace rule is either going to come out in June, effective in August, or come out in August, effective later in the year. But that's next in the down the pipe in a couple of months. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no real surprises in the timing of this rule. For all that there was this talk about a press, you know, oh, we're going to have a special announcement Monday, this, that, and the other thing. It's been known for a while that this rule was going to be published in April. The only real surprise to me is that it's not a 60-day window. It's a 120-day window. So it's not taking effect for 4 months rather than it taking effect in June. But, yeah, the grayness, the vagueness, that is a deliberate part of this. Despite all the claims it's to clarify, the intent is to continue to be vague, especially as refers to 80% sellers. It's literally up to the ATF director to decide at what point your sale of 80% receiver blanks becomes firearms based on what you're also selling or based on how developed they are, because it says in there that the receiver blank can't have any holes drilled or index marks. And the ATF has been wonderfully confusing about what an index mark is, depending on, you know, how they feel about it, which is why can't remember the dude's name, the guy making the Lightning Link cards
nailed
for index marks because there was lasering of the shape, even though that wasn't even remotely engraving. But it's worth noting that as far as those are index marks, that's why you can't even mark that third hole in your receiver, because that's considered an index mark of saying, oh, you're going to drill there. So, you know, they've gone after people for doing that, even as a joke. And you will see receivers out there with a fake third hole marking. But if you look at the actual specs for an M16, the hole's not in the right place, because that's their outlet. It's not an index mark for the proper hole. It's just a mark on the side of the receiver. But, 80%ers are kind of screwed to the point where I don't think... I think these companies were built up on the basis that they didn't want to be FFLs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're going to stick around to be FFLs at this point. It's kind of like Firearms Unknown.
Well, also, what happens on the, if, you know, a group of the, I don't know the, any of these groups specifically. Like, I don't know, does Polymer 80 already have an FFL behind them or all that. That's one of the big ones that I know off the top of my head. But
I don't know if they have an FFL. The other one I know of is JSD Supply, or I guess Supply Zan's name, but JSD. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they have an FFL. They sell enough parts that they may actually have an FFL that they use to get broken guns to strip things out. But the question is, are they manufacturing FFLs or are they just O1s?
Yep. But either way, if you are a company that does not have one, but you are, have been making these products that up until a couple in a few weeks or a few months, it will be illegal. Do you have a grace period? Because I mean, you can't just get an FFL.
Not for those companies. Yeah. There's a grace period for marking inventory that FFLs already have, but no, those companies are not going to have a sales grace period. Their grace period is right now.
Yeah.
In terms of when the rule takes effect, and that's it. And you know, it's difficult too because they've basically been offering a product that's inviting because it's not serialized, but it's not really cheaper than a finished lower. If these people have to serialize it, and if their buyers have to get that 4473 done, the financial advantage really isn't there. You might as well buy an Arrow lower, or you know, a Palmetto State lower, or even a Poverty Pony Anderson.
There's also the issue of the, all right, what happens if I'm a crappy handyman and I'm just screwing around and I slip up and now I have entirely boogered up this 80% and it's never going. I drilled the holes sideways, or I cut one of the rails off of a pistol and all that. Well, now I don't just have a piece of polymer junk to throw in the trash. It's been a firearm this whole time.
Well, as far as that goes, I mean, you can still throw away firearms if something's broken. But I mean, there's definitely an issue of you cannot give away that receiver necessarily in states that limit transactions of firearms or that broken frame. You might have to say, okay, well, I want to give this to someone to work on. Now it can't just be, oh, here's my broken 80%, or you have a go at it. Like Washington State, you know, depending on how their state laws read, you'd look at be transferring that through an FFL. Here's my broken ass Glock frame for you to work on. But that is part of the new definition, is that they redefined what it means to be a destroyed receiver. And it's kind of different than it used to be in terms of the actual destruction. One of the things they did away with too is, you know, they used to have very specific diagrams for this is how you destroy this type of firearm, this is how you destroy that type of firearm, that mostly applied to people with unregistered machine guns, you know, found in an attic, whatever. Now they've gone to a more generic form, which, you know, supposedly, oh, that's great, that's less regulation. But really, it's a way of making people destroy receivers to the point that they can't be rebuilt as semi-autos easily, because you don't know where the cuts are supposed to be. Does the ATF consider those old cuts still useful? Well, the ATF is saying it supersedes their old guidance, so technically they haven't offered new guidance on the way to interpret this rule. And that's just literally designed to make it harder to take an old machine gun receiver, cut it up, and then reassemble it or remanufacture it as a semi-auto receiver. That's all that is. That's just a petty move. But it does also affect, you know, other firearms. Is your broken 80% or something that in your state you can easily dispose of now? It's a problem.
Well, thank you so much for your clarification of how murky these waters are. We went long, but I think it was well worth our time. So
sure.
I'd like to thank firearms lawyer Benjamin Blatt for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, so last week when we talked about this, you and I were just aghast at how complicated and dumb it sounded. And so now that an actual lawyer has analyzed it, it's even worse. Oh, God.
It sounded complicated and dumb because it's complicated and dumb.
It's needlessly complicated and avoidably dumb. Oh, my God.
And all in the name of clarification. And clarification for crap that we already knew.
Again, I mean, that's the listed reason. The cynic in me wonders if that's really why it was.
Oh,
or,
of course,
like you
not.
Said, if they wanted it to stifle innovation and try and kill the gun industry.
I mean, this is the same angle as Mara Healey's little assault weapon ban edict. Mara Healey is the Attorney General of Massachusetts. She wants to be the governor, but currently she is our Attorney General, and the Attorney General has absolutely no power to create law. The only thing she can do is interpret law and give guidance to the enforcement of the law. And she has suddenly declared that, oh, I have discovered some text within the what is the federal assault weapons ban, and have discovered that, oh, we've been enforcing it wrong this whole time. And instead, pretty much if you use a AR-15 magazine release or an AR-15 pistol grip or an AR-15 bolt carrier, it's an AR-15 and it's a copycat, and therefore it is an assault weapon and therefore is illegal in the state of Massachusetts. And this makes absolutely no sense. And there's further, I always go back when talking about that, is she cites that 22 rimfire guns are exempted. Doesn't specifically say how, like, can I have an AR-15 in 20, so long as it's in 22, that has a collapsible stock and a threaded barrel? Probably not. I don't know. And she's not very clear about it either. And you need to play Mother May I instead of her giving you a straight answer. But again, the whole point is, I went through both the Massachusetts bill, which mostly references the federal bill, and then read the federal bill cover to cover. It's not actually not super long. It's about 8 pages long, I think, if I remember correctly. And there is only one reference in the entire bill about caliber. And that statement was caliber is not important. So the whole idea was that you couldn't rechamber an AR-15 and 224 wild and have that and say, because it's in 224 wild, it's not an AR-15 because AR-15s are in 223 or 556. And that's it. But yet she has caliber distinctions within her ruling, which came from nowhere, because it's not about interpretation of the law and not about clarification. It's about, we want to do something. What can we get away with doing?
I know I said it last week, but I really don't have anything else intelligent to say about this other than just to sputter indignantly at the idiocy.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder what will happen if this works the way they want it to, and the ATF now has fewer jobs to do, and they start losing their budget, and they have to fire agents. Because the entire job of every bureaucracy is to maintain its existence. That's why, I don't know, you know, I'm sure you know this. If you are a federal department, and you are given a budget, and if you do not spend all of that money, you're a fool, because the next year the accountants are going to say, well, you didn't need that money, mm-hmm. so we're going to reduce your budget. So even if you don't need it, you will spend it on garbage things so that you don't lose money.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine that the same thing works with personnel. And, oh, hey, because of this, we require fewer ATF agents, and we're going to have to fire them. Or whatever. I understand it's hard to fire people in the government, but
you could lay them off, though.
Well, yeah, it's like, well, we don't have any work and we don't have any money. Oops, too bad.
Yeah, you could cut the budget, and yeah, you have to eliminate positions. Again, I think I said this last week was when I worked for the federal government, I watched federal scientists cook the numbers so that they could make it sound like things were worse than they were, because mm-hmm. if a report came out of the National Fisheries Service that said that, oh, the fisheries regulations seem to be working because we're catching fish and the fishermen are making money and the fish are able to, you know, rejuvenate their populations, and so therefore we're not, the fish stocks aren't decline, good, we did it right. the solution to that would be, cool, we'll lay off 75% of your staff and we'll just keep a pilot light on. You can have one person that'll just go, that'll spend most of their life in hotel rooms going from port to port, checking out the fish stocks and seeing how things and seeing if there's anything dropping off. And yeah, if we see any problems, we'll hire more people. But until then, have fun finding work somewhere else.
Yeah, and I would be fine with that if it weren't for the fact that it's not going to happen immediately. And in the intervening time, they're going to do massive amounts of damage mm-hmm. to this country, to the firearms industry, to innovation, to maybe to military advancement. It's, oh, God.
Yeah, and the big thing that I'm wondering about is how many of these 80% people are going to be just crushed because there's just no way for them to conduct business, because if they are selling these as serialized parts, well, then you have to deal and trade with this, not a Glock and not a functional gun. I've got to be cutting some audio of President Biden's speech where he reached over and picked up a Glock kit and said, see, look at these. You can put it together. It's not hard. Yeah, so do it. No, you can't. You literally can't. Yes, there's a barrel and a slide, and there's a trigger pack, and there's a frame. And at no point can any of those parts be put together to form a gun. You need to machine them and get them doing, and you need to do a good job of doing it. And if all of that is being treated as a gun and has all the restrictions and things like that, and probably some markup because of all the compliance that would need to be done, well, screw it. I'll just buy a real Glock or one of the many not a Glocks that you can buy fully assembled from the various manufacturers. And So they might go out of business. Meanwhile, the government's going to be sued because this is crap and there's absolutely no standing. And that doesn't mean we're going to win, but there's absolutely no standing for any of this to go through. And so to suddenly have in the court rules, oh yeah, no, that's crap. So yeah, just strike that. Well, they're already out of business.
Mm-hmm.
So it is shameful government weaselry that is going on right now.
I'm trying to decide how I feel about tagging Home Depot, Lowe's, etc., and the ATF. Because on the one hand, I enjoy the impish sense of humor, and I enjoy sticking it to the ATF. On the other hand, it really seems like a dick move. And maybe it should be, maybe it is justified, but it does seem like it's being unnecessarily harsh to the Home Depot and the Lowe's and et cetera.
Well,
so I don't know how I feel about it.
How I feel about it is I would not do it at my local hardware store or plumbing supply store that's in town, where it's just the you know, we've got a plumbing supply store in town. It's in like an industrial park, and you can just walk in, and it's just a bare warehouse with a cash register on one side of it. And you just mm-hmm. go through, and you can pick out whatever the heck you want. And they're just in cardboard boxes. And yeah, it's a really, really cool place if you need to get something on the cheap. And that's just an independent dude running a store. And If the ATF comes after him for selling me a slam fire shotgun kit, that could be crushing for him. But
oh, yeah. Yeah. We're not going to go after the small business mom and pop things. It would be the big businesses.
Yeah. But the good news about is people, places like Home Depot. And I don't know too much about the corporate holdings. I'm pretty sure Home Depot is part of a much larger conglomerate. And I'm sure Lowe's is the same way, and Walmart and the various other places where you can get plumbing supplies and all.
Okay,
that.
Now Walmart. Okay, I don't hate Walmart. Mm-hmm. Like, it's fashionable for a lot of people to do, but they've got an entire team of attack lawyers. I would be worried that they would go after me, but if there's anyone who can really hurt the government, A lawsuit funded by Walmart might do it.
That's exactly where I'm sitting, is that yes, they could try to go after you, but I think whistleblower laws would actually probably protect you, and the lawyers would probably know well enough to go, no, they're reporting what they think is a crime, and what they're doing isn't illegal or defamatory. And so the key is instead going, why is the ATF now declaring that my rack of raw plumbing materials for people doing home improvements and for contractors and plumbers putting toilets into houses and installing sinks is now being considered firearms parts? Like, we, it's in no way, shape, or form a gun. And you go, have you seen a Sten gun? And so I could see that as one of those games that would quickly be settled out of court, if you will, because, I mean, honestly speaking, I could see it also as being just selective enforcement of the ATF would blow us off, because just like all those people after the, was it after the Sandy Hook shooting? I'm trying to remember which mass shooting it was, where all those people were cutting their AR-15s up to destroy them and show solidarity for the mass shooting and demand for an assault weapons ban. And,
no, I believe that was after Parkland.
Yeah, and there were several people that were cutting their guns up in very much in ways that was not legal destruction of the firearm, and therefore they were creating short-barreled rifles. And those people, not a one of them was prosecuted.
Mm.
And so, yeah, selective enforcement is the flavor of the month for ATF.
Just like that one guy, however many, I think it was like at least a decade ago, they were talking about Washington, D.C.'s magazine ban. And he had in his hand what we would consider a standard capacity AR-15 magazine. David Gregory. I believe that's his name. Mm-hmm. And it was like, look, we know where the studio's at. He shouldn't have it. He's committing a crime. And people actually reported him both to the police and I believe to the ATF or FBI or something like that. And of course, nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
God.
Yep.
I'm tired of being grumpy, weird. Oh, the stupidity doesn't stop.
No, well, gun control is stupidity, unfortunately, which is insulting because all we're trying to do is have people have the freedom to own the guns they want and to protect their lives and all that. And gun control is always preached under safety, and it doesn't cause greater safety. I mean, we just talked about the New York subway shooting, all of the rules in New York City, and yet this dude still came onto the subway and shot a whole bunch of people. And the Pittsburgh shooting, these people were all underage, and probably some of them had probably the shooters had criminal backgrounds. I'm willing to bet. We shall see. We'll let you know next week, probably, when they catch them. It's just gun control doesn't work, and we have the receipts. We have detail that shows that it doesn't work. And so they have to play these stupid games to try to make it look like gun control is good and to push gun control through. I mean, the good news is that they are playing stupid games, and we're not like back in the 90s when they actually would run an actual bill through. You know, or go back to the 30s when we want to ban alcohol. Well, let's have a constitutional amendment, and they friggin' did it. I mean, that just seems so alien these days that they would go through and put a constitutional amendment for banning alcohol, which isn't even in the Constitution. Yet we can say you can't build your own gun at home if it's from a kit. Because we've just decided that it's not even a law. I think it's time to thank our listeners. Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcaliberspodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus they get bonus content like the hilarious blooper reels that are much lighter than this show, the ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on the platform of your choice, and share the show with your friends, both online and off.
And you get more from me and my blog, that's weirdworld.com, and you can hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
Yeah, and you can find me in all the usual places, my nerd blog Lurking Rhythmically, and my prepping blog Blue Collar Prepping, and pinkpistols.org, and blazingsword.org, and does anyone really listen this far? I get the feeling you, like, hit stop or skip or whatever, basically the moment he says thanks to each and every one of our listeners.
Yeah, but we work it up different every time, and then after I thank Nate Spencer for our music, you come up with an outro that's always brilliant.
Oh, it's always brilliant.
Always brilliant. Just wait. Just wait.
No pressure or anything. You know what? I'm going to do this just to spite you. This outro is not going to be brilliant at all. He's from Maine, and I like tacos, and that's why our podcast is assorted. Good morning, everyone.
Happy birthday.